we've been starting to use this word intelligent automation, right? So it's not like putting in robots and conveyor belts, still extremely important. But can you create automation with data and analytics? Because I don't have enough great people to be watching, listening, looking at everything.
Welcome to Manufacturing Happy Hour, the podcast where we get real about the latest trends and technologies impacting modern manufacturers.
Manufacturing
Happy Hour. Each week, we interview industry experts that are at the top of their craft and give you the tools, tactics, and strategies you need to take your career and your business to the next level. And now, your host, Chris Lukey.
Hey, what's up? It's episode 186, and today we've got a story about how bringing clean water to Africa led to digitizing the electronics industry. Our guest this week is Andrew Schoerman, co-founder and CEO of Arch Systems, specializing in machine data for electronics and discrete manufacturers and powering predictive analytics. I will give everyone listening here a call to action up front. If you have a friend in the electronics manufacturing industry, send this episode their way. But also, like I said, this episode is a startup story. So if you have a friend or colleague that loves traveling, that works with nonprofits, has a startup of their own, or is just into startups, send this episode to them as well. Let me tell you a bit more about what you can expect from this interview. First, for the first part of the conversation, we head to Africa, to rural Tanzania, to hear the backstory of Arch Systems and how it was born out of a clean water project. Second, we'll hear some stories about how Arch Systems is helping some of the world's largest electronics manufacturers leverage data to detect and fix problems preemptively. Finally, and really this is throughout the whole conversation, we'll learn how Andrew's work with both nonprofits and startups has been inherently intertwined and what he's learned from having experiences in both worlds. As always, if you want to learn more, go to the show notes page at manufacturinghappyhour.com/186. And if you want to take part in conversations and connect with folks like Andrew, well, hey, you got to be hanging out in the Manufacturing Happy Hour industry community. Today, that group lives on LinkedIn. There are 700 manufacturing leaders that are in that group, helping push one another's career forward. Go to manufacturinghappyhour.com/community to get taken straight to our private community. Shoot me a note, request to join, and we will let you right in. And with that, it's time to get started. Let's meet up with Andrew for today's interview. Andrew, good to have you on the show today, and you know what's coming. If we were having this conversation over a beverage, where would that be? Set the tone.
Well, let's see. I'm based in the Bay Area, and most of the good bars are up in San Francisco, which I used to go to more before I had kids. So, but I found a really sweet spot in Los Altos called Amandine Lounge. Feels like it should be in the city, but it's stuck here in the suburbs. It's this little like crack in the wall, and then they've just got these just absolutely incredible kind of mixed drinks, like passports from all over the world. So you can kind of have a cool, you know, mixed drink from Italy or from Japan or whatever. It's a nice one.
That's cool. An international themed spot. You said Amandine Lounge. Is that what it was called?
It's called Amandine Lounge. Yeah. And I mean, back in the day, I always like just enjoyed a good beer. I went to college at University of Florida, but I was a little too cheap to go to bars back then. And there were parties and you could find them anywhere. So
sure. Well, whether we're drinking cheap beers or Italian cocktails or cocktails from anywhere in the world, I would want to ask you this next question as if we were having a drink, right? How do you describe what Arch Systems does really briefly when you're having a beverage with someone?
Well, that's a good one. Yeah. Sitting at the bar versus what does Arch Systems do? If I'm sitting next to someone, this is a manufacturing podcast, right? But I would ask them, like, have you ever been in a factory before, right? Because, you know, some people have, and then I love hearing their story, but some people, I don't know, never been in one. But so you ever been in a factory before? And So picture a factory. There's all these machines. There's people. They're working together to try to build a product, right? And often, because I'm sitting at the bar, I'm going to hold up my
my iPhone, right? I'll be like, you know, maybe they're making a phone just like this. There's that green circuit board on the inside. You know, there's putting chips on top, baking it, slapping the case on, screwing it down, getting it done. There's all kinds of problems that can come up on the factory floor. They can have bottlenecks. They were supposed to make 1,000 units. They only got 800. You know, why? There was defects. You know, the camera's not on right. A chip's not on correctly. You know, what's going on? So what we do is we help solve those problems. We get data out of all the machines and we put it together and help guide the people in the factory to solve those problems.
Now, we're going to get into Arch Systems later in the conversation, but as I understand it from, you know, the stories I've heard leading up to this, you have a unique story of how Arch Systems came to be. It's not necessarily the traditional, this is how a manufacturing technology startup came to be. So let's start here. Where did you meet your co-founder, Tim? And then we'll get into some of the other details.
Yeah, so I mentioned I was at, did my undergrad at University of Florida. I studied chemistry and econ, and then I came to Stanford to do a PhD in material science. And Tim was my co-founder, Tim Berg. We were like each other's first friend. I think we met like on the visit week. He was also, he had been actually in Panama for 3 years with the Peace Corps, whole other story. But that's how we met. We were there on visit week. We bumped into each other, just dropped into like deep conversation about the world, technology, engineering, all kinds of stuff. And we both were like, all right, this is a cool person.
It's funny. I did not go into the Peace Corps, but I did visit my friend when he was finishing his stint with the Peace Corps in Panama. So I got like a 10-day taste of what Panama was like from the perspective of someone that had just gone through the Peace Corps. So that's a story for another day. This is your show today. And the next question I want to ask is, so Tim had some Peace Corps experience. You met him at Stanford. You were doing your PhDs. Why did you decide to go to Africa after completing your PhD? There's more story to unfold here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, see, fast forward 4 or 5 years or something, we're doing our PhDs, heads down, and Tim is a theoretician, so he's doing predictive analysis of why electrons move in solar cells. I was an experimentalist, so I was building semiconductor equipment. And so, you know, the normal thing that we would have done after a PhD is go work for probably a semiconductor company. In my case, like an applied materials, you know, build these semiconductor equipment, something like that, right? Why do we go to Africa? It really starts with Tim, my co-founder. So I mentioned he was in the Peace Corps and you were there in Panama as well. You saw it. He's a big heart for sustainable development, as I do as well. And he had observed a number of problems when he was in. He was also in Nicaragua and Panama. He was working on power systems, also water, right? So we take a lot of stuff for granted in the U.S. You live in a city, wherever you are, just a lot of things are just there, right? But my grandparents were farmers in Illinois, and they had a ground well, and that thing could go wrong. And so it's not that far back, and maybe some people watching the show also have that understanding that you can lose access to your water pretty easily if you're not in some big city. So Tim was seeing that where he was, Nicaragua and in Panama. And so before I had, you know, I was his friend, we were doing our PhDs, but he joined a nonprofit called Well Done. And maybe some of the folks listening have maybe even donated to some of these great causes to build a well for people in Africa and Southeast Asia and any kind of, you know, poor part of the world. And the problem was 40% of the wells in sub-Saharan Africa were just broken. So a charity group, a nonprofit, a church, whatever it was funding this, amazing, giving people water. And in less than a year, this machine, this simple machine, the well, was broken and not helping anybody. So I'll pause there. But that's how it started, was, you know, Tim really being into this problem. And he and I were living together in a basement in Los Santos. Yeah. And I was watching him get really interested in this problem and want to help this nonprofit doing these wells.
So then my question to continue this story is, what got you to get off a top dead center, pull the trigger to go be part of the solution to this problem?
So Tim and I are both doing our PhDs. That's our main thing, semiconductor research, predictive analytics, right? And my side hustle was actually, I helped build a startup accelerator called StartX,
which I don't know if anyone listening here is into startups, they may have heard of like Y Combinator, 500 startups. So StartX was one of the top five best ones. And we got to start a fund. We actually got to invest $200 million out of Stanford's endowment in terms of tons of companies. Founder of Snapchat, Evan Spiegel, was like early on there. I had DoorDash in my program. I incubated them.
So nice.
I had to touch like a bunch of amazing early startups. So I was just kind of like embedded in like Silicon Valley startups and everything. And in the basement of our shared house with Tim, I'm always telling him about StartX and startups and like big ideas. And he's starting to work on these wells in Africa with this existing nonprofit called Well Done. And Well Done itself started also raising money for wells until they realized how many of them were broken. And they were like, maybe instead of fundraising some more, we should go try to get them fixed with this idea of IoT. Like we could get data and we could say if they're actually working or not, or even predict if they're working or not. And as he was moving more to that idea and I was doing startups, we started like, you know, seeing more like shared interests and getting super interested. And I guess the funny story is it started out with Tim and he had another business partner, Austin. The three of us ended up being co-founders. They were like, we need another person to help us on this. And I was like, oh, I've helped DoorDash. You know, I was there on Snapchat. I was getting started. I've helped all these cool companies and lots of good industrial ones too, not just consumer ones. And I was like, I can help you find your third person. That's my thing, is helping people connect, right? So it wasn't going to be me initially. I was going to help them find somebody else. And as we kept like talking about the problem and everything going on, I was like, actually, I really want to do this. You know, so I kind of put my hand up. And then luckily they were like, oh, we were really hoping that you would be interested, right? So I joined them. And that was when our third co-founder, Austin, he actually moved to Africa. He lived there for 2 years. And then we got a grant from the World Bank to monitor about 10,000 people's drinking water, about 50 major wells. And that was when the project, started, you know, really, you know, went from maybe just, you know, build one monitor, two monitor, build 50 well monitors on a shoestring budget. See, could you actually pull off something like this?
I have a new question for you that I'd like to ask you. Was there ever any point? Because you mentioned that in like the perfect world or like the path that I was on, I probably would have been working at Applied Materials or something like that.
Yeah.
The fact that you were going down a fairly different path, let's call it that. Maybe you can tell me how different it really was, because I think there is some good overlap between these things. How did you feel about the path you were going on? Did you feel like you were deviating from what you were meant to do, what you wanted to do, or on the flip side, were you like, this is definitely the right decision? Like, just tell me what was going through your mind.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. At the time, I felt like I was deviating a lot. Looking back, it's more obvious, because the funny thing now is both Tim and I, a lot of our colleagues that were doing material science, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering at Stanford at the same time, you know, some of them are at like an Applied Materials building advanced semiconductor equipment or electronics machines or others. Some of them are at like BCG, Accenture, McKinsey, doing strategic consulting into factories. And some of them are working for direct manufacturers. So a lot of them are actually like kind of circling a similar space. And then, you know, we started this company. And then, you know, fast forward, we'll get back to it. We focus on electronics manufacturing later, right? So, you know, now it kind of makes more sense. But at the time, it really felt like I was doing something very different. And are we really using our PhDs directly? You know, because, yeah, we were making a little device and we were doing predictive analytics. But like predicting whether a well is going to break, pretty different than how an electron moves. And like, it's about as different as you can get. You think about my background, like a semiconductor equipment costs millions of dollars for a new machine. It's got thousands of sensors on the inside. It's as complex as you can get. Almost nobody can afford them. And then on the flip side, this like as cheap as you can get well that you just crank to get water out. You know, these seemed kind of, it wasn't like, oh yeah, one machine, another machine. It's like, no, these are totally different, right? So it felt like we were going off, but we were following our passion, a problem that we knew was important. And yeah, you're younger, you're earlier in your career, you're like, I have some time to you know, make a mistake or re-divert or solve different problems.
So let's go. I mean, you're doing predictive analytics for wells. Like, quite frankly, I think there's a good amount of overlap there. A killer foundation experience. Certainly one it sounds like you look back on fondly. Let's talk about the problem that you discovered when you were over there. Like, what was revealed that, what was the issue with the water and the wells? And how'd you go about solving it?
Oh my gosh, yeah. If you go online, or I think on our website too, on our about page, there's these amazing pictures of these wells. And they're usually these metal hand crank type of wells. So you do bore, you get in groundwater, and you know, you can pump. And ideally it doesn't take a ton of strength, and you can get the water to come out and get fresh, clean water. And there's this picture of the well with a goat tied up to it, because it's become a trash area. And there's just like trash scattered around, the goat's eating it. And that picture is like worth 1,000 words, because it's like, what happened here? This was supposed to be like the source of life, this clean drinking water, and it's a trash area, right? And like, you would see those things in these areas, and you were just, what the heck was going on, right? And there was a couple problems. Like, sometimes it was a full-on people problem. Like, maybe the local people didn't trust, like, why, who's giving me this solution? What is this thing? And they actually disregarded it on purpose. That's its own really complex challenge that the World Bank studied and had other people write about. But the challenge that we were really focused on wasn't where they didn't want to use it or didn't trust it. It was where they really tried to use it. They got it. This is fantastic. This is water. And especially the place where our third co-founder, Austin, lived, that was the case. They had a great relationship. They were able to be there, talk. And it was just that the wells would break. They would malfunction. And there were a variety of reasons. But, you know, anyone in manufacturing, like, all machines break. It's not a question of if, it's just when, right? And the more you use it, the more it's going to break. There might have been a defect. It might break earlier. It might just be based on usage, right? And so they would break. And the problem was painfully simple, is that there was no maintenance. You're out here in rural Tanzania, where we started. We did this in a variety of countries. And there's no utility company, really. There's people that would like come around on a bicycle, maybe, every once in a while, if at all. There was no maintenance. And so really the problem, you know, was this just grand lack of visibility. Like, the people who have money, the people who care, the people in the city who have a utility company, they just don't even know. They're just completely disconnected from the operations on the floor, so to speak, right? From the from these villages. And the well breaks, the people don't feel empowered to ask for help, to go anywhere, but just go back to drinking out of the river, right? So that was really the problem. And so it wasn't that, you know, in most cases that they didn't want the help, that they didn't want the water. And it wasn't that there weren't people who wanted to help and could, you know, potentially come in and do maintenance. It was connecting the data, the intelligence of like, here are the wells that need help now. Actually bring the maintenance. And so the predictive part was really valuable, but even just knowing it was broken at all to begin with. So, you know, you go from like zero visibility, and that we talk about this in manufacturing all the time, right? You go from like descriptive to predictive to prescriptive, right? Or descriptive diagnostic, predictive prescriptive, right? People like to say that, like, is there even a problem? Can you say it at all? Why is it happening? Can you predict it in advance? And you keep getting more advanced in that chain, right?
So it's a maintenance issue, right? And I guess another question I have is, how did you start prioritizing what wells needed attention, or kind of getting to where our system goes? How did you start thinking about the data and the connectivity to fix problems before they arose, to prevent wells from breaking altogether? How did you start doing that?
Absolutely. So, you know, first off, I'll say that So there's a nonprofit called Well Done International, which still does this work. And when Arch was incorporated by Tim and Austin, yeah, I told the story of how I joined them, and I was doing StartX. I was helping all these startups get started. They incorporated a company as Well Done Technologies. And so the very actually kind of Cambrian beginning of the story was, we did this World Bank project together, monitored 50 wells, got a bunch of amazing data of what's working, what's not working, made some great reports and helped out. And then there was this chasm between
doing great research reports of the problem and monitoring wells for 6 months or a year until, you know, battery or until early prototype. Because again, you can't build an amazing IoT network on 80K. You know, companies have even raised $10, $20 million and they still crash because their technology is not working well enough. So we were basically told, and it was correct, you know, the nonprofit sector, the World Bank, is not supposed to back new technology foundation. So this is where the pivot starts happening, is we on a shoestring budget, you know, led by Tim, my co-founder, he can build anything. The guy is absolutely amazing. And he builds these shoestring budget devices that can do this, right? And we do, and then the software part, you're asking about the predictive. You go from the hardware to the software, you can do even more on a shoestring budget with amazing software, right? But what happened was, it was like, okay, there's this big gap. Like, we've actually got to put a real system in place that can run forever and has a company. And World Bank's like, you know, we don't back that. And so this thinking evolves to like, there's got to be a for-profit company that can build industrial models and change this technology. Because at the time, and I mean, you know, well, the Rockwells of the world and Schneiders and Siemens, et cetera, the kind of what was missing was like a PLC, right? A little programmable logic controller on these wells. They weren't smart machines. They needed a new sensor. And at the time, the cheapest PLC was a couple thousand bucks, not to mention it wasn't really set up to be on a cellular network, right? And so you think about all the equipment you would need for one well, it was going to be far beyond the cost of the entire well. And so it was not, yeah, we did it on a shoestring budget for 50 wells, but there was a reason it costs what it costs, right? You've got to have a whole company, an apparatus, manufacture these things, support them. And so we realized there was this massive gap on cost affordability. So that's actually what started our journey to say, let's go build a for-profit company and try to make some massive disruption on how much this stuff costs to do. And, you know, the nonprofit has continued on its mission, and we've been able to help them a number of times, sometimes directly through technology, other times through stock or some donations, right? But that was kind of an early pivot that was motivating. That wasn't, you know, I mean, I hope everybody at Arch, you know, makes great money from having an amazing company, but it didn't start out as a, you know, to make money. It started out just like chasing that initial problem of the wells, and then being like, there's a gap in enabling technology. Let's see if we can do that.
We'll be back in a moment, but first, a quick word from our sponsor. Are you looking for a B2B e-commerce solution that's built to scale across multiple channels? Then you need to check out our newest sponsor, Zenode. Zenode is a B2B e-commerce platform created for managing complex e-commerce. In the industrial world, you've got manufacturers, you've got dealers and distributors, and of course you have the customer. Zenode brings the entire channel together to create a seamless experience for your customers. Plus, its API-first architecture means fewer integrations and costs so that your focus is getting to market faster. I'm going to keep it short and sweet today, because to learn more, you need to tune in to next week's episode to hear it straight from Zenode. But in the meantime, visit Zenode.com. And now, back to today's interview.
I have a couple questions here. You were part of the nonprofit. You started your own business because ultimately, if you were going to solve these problems and ultimately bring the cost of technology down over time, you were going to need to run a for-profit business that could afford to do that type of thing, if I'm hearing that correctly. So how do you strike that right balance between nonprofits and for-profit businesses, right? What's the right way for these groups to work together? Because you're obviously passionate about that problem, but the infrastructure, the nature of a nonprofit isn't necessarily meant to solve that issue by developing the technology. What's the right balance, or how have you found that balance in your personal life and professional life?
Yeah, you know, I've worked at that intersection a lot because you know, we're talking here about Well Done, the Wells, and Arch. And before that, I helped build Startex. Startex is a 501c3 nonprofit as well. And it's not a typical venture capital fund, which makes money on investments. It's a nonprofit that has a model of sponsorships to just like help a community of startups, right? But on the flip side, having a fund, is a really great way to make returns and then be able to invest in more startups, right? So you have to just like kind of recognize like there are certain problems that fit a for-profit and certain ones that fit a nonprofit. And once you figure that out, it's actually really clear, but it doesn't make sense to fight it, right? If you're like, hey, let me have a nonprofit model, but invest a lot in companies, or let me have a nonprofit model, but try to build super expensive sensor technology and predictive analytics. It'll be like, well, how's that going to work? Like, who's going to, you know, on the flip side, you have a for-profit and you go, our entire for-profit will help the poorest customers in Tanzania. You'd love to do that, but you'll say, can they really pay that much? Like, either you're going to collect no profit or you're going to squeeze these people with your for-profit company who have nothing to pay. You might do worse for the world than good, right? So basically you have to recognize like what kind of problem you're going after and pick the right one. And that was how, you know, it is personal, right? Because at the time, you know, hindsight's 20/20, you learn a lot more about the world, you get more practical as you get older. But at the time, it was painful, right? Because you're always, everybody's a little more bright-eyed, optimistic. I mean, I'm still a very optimistic person, but you get more practical as you get older. And I was like, you know, oh, let's just solve this problem directly and let's raise, you know, tons and tons of money to do this. And it didn't make sense at first when you're getting those rejections. Why can't we just raise a ton of money and directly solve this? People need help. And then you're like, okay, they need help, but it's not worth that many dollars, unfortunately. And that like that hurts. You're like, oh, there's something wrong with the world. But you're like, no, actually that's how the world works, right? So I think, at least for me, like, you know, I did a PhD at Stanford, so I like to, and I'm not trying to say like I'm like a super smart guy, like I'm to make dumb mistakes all the time, but like I do like to try to understand stuff. And when for me, I was able to like kind of understand like what kind of problem works in a nonprofit and a for-profit. And then it's like, okay, let's make an amazing for-profit company that can create enabling technology and bring it to places like factories that can be transformed in a profitable way. And that's going to make the world a much better place. And then let's transfer technology, you know, pieces that are open source. And let's also, you know, give cash and donations to the nonprofit and enable them to do their mission. And so kind of having this hybrid model where you don't mix them, but you share the pieces that you can share was what we settled on.
Yeah, I think the way you wrapped up that answer makes a lot of sense because you have a long-term perspective to this, right? To build the technology that's needed to help other applications around the world, you kind of need that under a for-profit model. But the fact that you're still engaged, you're thinking about how that can be applied to those other applications over time, wells in Africa, for example. That's at least how I'm following your train of thought there. And you found a way to strike that balance. So,
yeah, I'll just share one other little anecdote. Like, number of years passed, but after the wells in Africa, we did a project with a group called Factory, backed by the Rockefeller Foundation. Kind of similar idea. It was in Kenya. And it was, how do you monitor predictive analytics on machines that help people make income in really poor countries? Like, I don't know if any of the listeners here ever heard of like the Heifer Project or these areas where you can like, you know, don't give a man a fish, teach a man to fish, or give him a cow, or get, you know, how about give people a machine so that they can sew clothes or make grain? But then those machines need energy and those machines can break. So we did a really cool study where we were applying our technology again to help monitor and figure out machines in Kenya, in this case, that were income generating machines for people in disadvantaged communities. So, you know, there's a lot of cool ways that you can transfer these technology ideas and try to help people who aren't directly part of our for-profit business model.
I think we're going to finish our conversation back in Africa, but we're going to fly back to San Francisco really quickly because I want to ask you a bit about Arch Systems, because we've gotten a bit of the origin story, right? You started making that pivot to building a for-profit business. Are there other details about how Arch Systems came to be that you want to share? And then I'm curious how you ended up getting focused on electronics manufacturing not too long after that. Like, that became your sweet spot. So share a bit more about the Arch Systems origin story.
Yeah, absolutely. So post-Wells, for-profit, let's fundamentally enable IoT, yeah, the buzzwords would be IoT and AI, you know, data collection and analytics and predictive analytics, right?
And this was 2015, 2016, still like AI. I mean, AI has been around for a long time, but it wasn't hot like it is now. So, I mean, you know, the very first thing we did, I wish, you know, we would have then been like, hey, what are we great at the world at? Like, I built inspection equipment and, you know, etch machines and microscopes and da-da-da, and Tim's predicted how electrons, like, let's go to electronics manufacturing. Let's just straight there, you know, and then like, we would have been like, hey, we understand this area. Maybe hired a couple of people that were veterans, spent 30 years in electronics manufacturing, get into the factories, boom. In 6 months, you know, the exact product market fit. That would have been amazing. But it took like 3 years kind of wandering in the wilderness, right? So the real story is like the very, you know, 1, 2, 3 version of it is we're doing wells in Africa. We try to do industrial wells. And our first customer was actually Netafim, world's largest drip irrigation company. And it was like, they have irrigation systems on industrial wells, farms and mines. And then from there, it was like, we started doing that worked. We made money, but it wasn't, we could tell it wasn't where we were going to stay long term. And then from there, we started doing pilots in factories and realizing, okay, actually machine and making the connection. Now you can see backwards. Yeah, well is a really simple machine, you know, a press brakes a little bit more complicated, a pick and place robot fully automated is yet more complicated, but they're all in the spectrum of machines that you could pull data out and do predictive maintenance, predictive quality, right? So we started making those connections and seeing it. We started spending a lot of times in factories, really figuring out the nuance of what the problem was in factories, which is deep and different than exactly the problem in obviously utilities or in a well or something like that. And then we had an early first partnership, which is now public, with Flex, one of the largest electronics manufacturers in the world. And Flex was one of our first, you know, very large manufacturing customer, one of our first customers overall. And they gave us large scale access to data. And that was what we needed. So we had kind of crossed the chasm, understood the problem, and then we were able to connect at a high level with an amazing company who said, okay, you know what? Here's all this data from factories around the world. We don't know what to do with it. It seems like you guys can figure this out. And we did. They gave us the shot and we succeeded.
How did you, this is a bit of a strong word, but how did you survive that 3-year period where you were really finding your sweet spot? Because maybe for someone that doesn't understand as much about startups, that can feel like a long period of time where it's like, you got to get your product market fit figured out or your startup is going to go under, for lack of a better word. Like, how did you navigate that 3-year period to make sure that you were getting to the spot you needed to be before time ran out?
That's a great question, because having been someone that helped a lot of other startups, on average, if it takes you 3-4 years to find product market fit, you're dead. Like, most people don't make that. Like, most of the great companies you see, it's not that they hit it right away, but within, let's say, less than 2 years, they hit it or they're dead because they run out of money. So like Amazon hit it really fast. There's some, like Airbnb actually took quite a while wandering the desert, you know, but that's a rarer story. I mean, ramen budget, right? Low cost, you know, convincing amazing people to come over on tiny fractions of their salary, long hours in the office, getting out into the field and all these places, just a lot of hustle and building amazing technology and trying to leave our ego at the door when we had to drop something that seemed amazing and try something else again, right? Just like pivoting. So it wasn't easy, but it was fun and fascinating, but it wasn't easy. And again, looking backwards, you can see how each experience builds on itself. You really understand more. But yeah, in the midst of it, there were definitely times, you know, we need to go to the Amandine Lounge or some of these bars, yeah, right, to tell all the stories. But there were a number of times that I thought we would make it. So
how did you know you found a fit with electronics manufacturing then? You know, after 3 years wandering the desert, I think is a fun way to describe it. What was, I mean, maybe there's concrete data, maybe there's a gut feel. What did it feel like?
Oh, it feels amazing. You know it when you've hit product market fit, because
before this is this term we use with startups, right? The product, the market, they're like, versus you're like, I built this. And people are like, why? Hammer, you know, like, I've got this problem. I have no idea how to solve it for you, right? So like beforehand, people are like, oh, cool. Yeah. IoT and AI. I mean, you people are listening. They know it too. Like, I've got some AI widget. And you're like, okay, but how does it help me? And nobody knows, right? It's cool, but like nobody knows why it's good. That's not product market fit. That's some cool technology, right? So we were like, I can get data out of your machine and predict. And people were like, and you know, now it seems more obvious, right? But you're like, that's maybe helpful, but like, you know, how, like, you know, I don't know. You're talking to someone that doesn't even have a ticketing system. So you're like, I could tell you when it's going to fail. And you're like, tell who, you know? Because like, you don't have a dashboard, or you weren't even thinking you were going to make a dashboard, right? So that, you know, there's all these like little problems that, looking backwards, once a technology is built and the use case is clear, like now Google search is clear. Everyone's like, oh yeah, you ask for what you want, it finds it, you know? But beforehand, people were doing it just in really different ways that didn't work. So I like, you know, how do you know? Like, you're just having a conversation with the customer and it's just, and they're just like, that makes sense. It's valuable. Like, yeah, you can talk about it. You can demonstrate it. You can do a pilot. The pilot creates value. You save $3 million already in a pilot, you know, because you stop a machine from breaking, you eliminate downtimes. And the customer's just like, how quick can I put this on more lines, right? And it's a pretty stark difference. And then you're like, wow, okay, like we're really helping the customer. It's not just like, cool, some cool tech, we should keep exploring. And you get moved from the R&D department to actual like operations because they want to use it in the factory versus play around in the lab, right?
It's funny when you tell someone what you do and they're like, oh, cool, oh, interesting, right? Because they're being polite, right? But you know, it's like, I don't think that this person may not get it, or more appropriately, they're probably just not the type of person that would ever buy this from us. It's not the product market fit. So that was, I appreciate you taking us through that. Let's talk about, you know, leveraging data to detect and fix problems preventively. Let's talk about Arch Systems a little bit as we're here in the last part of our interview. You know, what you mentioned, you're working with Flex. Like, what does this all look like in the context of a manufacturing application? How does this all click together to help a manufacturer?
Yeah. So, you know, today we work with Jabil, Flex, Plexus. We're in 6 of the 10 large electronics contract manufacturers. Work with great companies as well, like BAE Systems, Harman, so you know, automotive OEMs, aerospace and defense, and others. Really, proud to be working with a lot of amazing manufacturers that build great products. And you know what it looks like in each case is, you know, back to that, how do you describe ours at the bar? Like, you got your factory, you got your machines, you got your people, they're building a product, right? And all of those things, your people, your processes, the machines, or the products, so like say the 3 P's, people, processes, and products, they got a ton of data, tons of data. Manufacturers have been swimming in it. A lot of them have been trying to collect it all, throw it up into a cloud lake somewhere, and then it's like, what do I do with this, right? That's the most common thing you hear when you talk to manufacturers. Like, I know I have data, I have too much data, I don't know what to do with it, I can't make it actionable, right? So that, you know, it's as simple as that in words. And then, as you know, when we had to find that product market fit, prove it in a pilot, you do the right actions, right? So we call them intelligent actions. Is it, you know, you're looking at the data in real time, seeing there could be a maintenance problem, seeing there's a bottleneck, right? Seeing there's a defect, actually understanding the root cause. Yeah, you have a defect and actually your root cause is this one input material. Or you have a defect and you need to recalibrate the camera on that machine, or you need to do a maintenance action, and you're right most of the time, right? And so you can rapidly guide people to see the real problems, not distractions, and go fix solutions and see the results, right? And again, that's what we're trying to do for our customers, and why they value us, because we can cut through the noise of data. And you know, what's the like less glamorous part that is required to do that is like talking the alphabet soup of protocols, all these different machines, writing all kinds of old software to machines that are 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years old, right? Talking to all kinds of varieties and building some really cool advanced models and some really simple, but like good, solid domain knowledge models of like why things break, why things fail.
and putting that all together in a system that works 24/7, 365.
Next round of our interviews coming up right after a word from our sponsor. This episode is sponsored by Swipe Guide. Swipe Guide is helping frontline workers perform at their best through standard work instructions and skills development. Their clear-cut platform lets frontline teams coordinate instructions, job aids, and training to optimize processes. All of these aspects add up inside of a manufacturing operation, keeping motivation high and operations running. I mean, Swipe Guide is right in line with one of our biggest themes here on Manufacturing Happy Hour, empowering frontline teams. Their customers are saying the same thing. Here's a quote from a recent review. Swipe Guide has been fantastic for empowering our operators. They now have all the information and knowledge they need to do their jobs at their fingertips. Plus, if you really want to hear how Swipe Guide is making a difference for manufacturers, then head back and listen to episode 167, where Swipe Guide CEO Wilhelmine Schneider and Joris Stolk from Heineken jump on the show to discuss how Swipe Guide's impacted their global brewing operations. If you're a regular listener here, you know that talking about how technologies apply to brewing is certainly one of our favorite topics on the show. And you can get to that episode by going to manufacturinghappyhour.com/167. If you're looking for a hassle-free solution for sharing how-tos and boosting know-how across frontline teams, then look no further and head to swipeguide.com today. And now, back to today's interview.
Where do most people, what specific aspect are most people struggling with when you meet them? Is it they have all the data, they don't know how to do with do they don't know what to do with it, they haven't gathered the data yet, or they're messing with the data but they're not getting to the right root cause, as you were talking about with intelligent actions to get to the right root cause to figure out why you're having defects? Like where in the spectrum are people?
So it is all of those. The large customers we have so far were further along. Right. So they had gathered the data. They were messing with it, kind of like you said, but they weren't really figuring out the right root cause. So their analytics weren't really working. And often it was the case that they hadn't gathered all the right rich data as well. So they had actually cherry picked data because it's already expensive. It's hard to do it. They cherry picked maybe the wrong data. They're not getting the results they want, throwing their hands up in the air, or they're starting over with redoing connectivity. That is the most common place where we start with a customer. And we scale the connectivity piece 10x faster, get all this rich data. There's stuff that used to be the case. People were like, leave data on the edge. Don't bring it to the cloud. It's too expensive. We bring all of it to the cloud on our bill. Customers pay zero for it. We save it forever because technology's changed. We can actually save all the... We process more than a billion data points a day. And it's a secret I could share with you, listeners. You know, our cloud bill is not that expensive. So we're extremely good at compressing all this data. And then when we have all of the rich data, any analytics that are possible, like you can't, you know, if it's like if with all the data, it's still impossible. Okay, fine. You can't predict it, right? But if you have all the data, if it's possible to predict it, we will predict it, right? And so we've made it 10x or more lower cost to get all the rich data into one place, into the right data format, and then to do that. So that's where we find the customers most. But as we're growing and as more people are getting excited about this, we are going to manufacturers that hadn't even started and they were waiting to know that it was going to work. And we're starting to get customers like that who see the results that, you know, a Flex or a Jabil or Plexus are having, or, you know, a BAE or a Harman, and are saying like, okay, I waited for a reason, so I wouldn't turn my wheels. Now maybe it's the time to actually start. Arch, give me a really low cost pilot. Wow, just works. Okay. So we're starting to see more of those folks also come to us.
Give us a quick story, an example of, you don't necessarily need to name the specific customer, but an example of how this plays out. What was the problem? What did you find? How did you solve it? I'd love to hear that as we get to the end of the conversation.
Yeah, so many I could tell. I'll pick different high volume automotive. It's coming to mind. One of the pilots that I loved. So we connected up a ton of machines in a factory in Mexico and in Eastern Europe. And these were circuit board lines. Great, no, not a phone. This was automotive components, but that green circuit board with the chips on top, right? The PCBA factory. And we've connected all the data, we're analyzing it, and we see these terrible bottlenecks. These are lines that have a big backlog. So what's the problem, right? This is not a factory that just has no sales orders and is sitting there, needs to do sales, right? This is a factory that has a backlog. They haven't been able to hire enough people and train them. They're about to make a $21 million investment in more machines and robots, a lot of which was a good investment to make, but because they just can't squeeze more product through these lines with the people, that they don't necessarily have the people to go with those $20 million investment. So they got this crunch of capital expense and people to meet this backlog. And that's a really common thing. And they don't realize that they've got these huge bottlenecks on their existing lines that they thought shouldn't be there, right? And so we analyze all the data. And for example, more complex problem and a simple problem. So simple problem first. On one of the lines, we just see these horrible bottlenecks at the placement robots. They're just sitting there idle all the time waiting. And we see that the test program, the machine is just testing forever, forever, forever. And we show how this big problem, here's the root cause, losing like more than 20% efficiency on these high volume lines because you're testing forever. Your robots are sitting doing nothing. And the engineers look at it and they go, we knew that we had to run a really long test program. It was supposed to be all this buffering capacity so that the robots would be highly used. And they're like, why aren't the buffers working? And they call the factory. The guy goes to the line. He says, there's no buffer here. He goes, what do you mean there's no buffer? I was just in that factory like 5 weeks ago. And it was like, this was a simple problem. At the end of the day, they left out a key piece of the line. And there was no observability, almost a little bit like the well back in Africa, right? It just couldn't really see that there was this broken piece in the middle and not realize how much the robots are just sitting still, not even moving. It's like, oh my gosh, can't believe it, right? So that was one. And then, another example, a little more complex, was, line with all these changeovers. Changeover managements are hard in manufacturing. You're doing different products all the time and not realizing as you're doing the changeovers how much losses you were having. Or, specific test programs like bottlenecking that change over time. And so, that one's more advanced. If we were looking at the analysis, you could see a Pareto of multiple things to do to optimize this changeover. But kind of when you added up some of the missing buffers and some of the changeover optimizations, I mean, we found more than $7 million of value in just a couple of months. And so it was a huge one. Create a ton of value right off the bat and really clear root causes that you've found with certainty, right? So it's a little different than your like predictive maintenance on the machine example. That's like of a bottleneck and like industrial engineering example. But yeah, whether it's maintenance, industrial engineering, or quality, that's like those are the moments we love when you like find a really clear problem, get to solve it, and you know for sure you've just unlocked a lot of capacity, right?
What is the reason so many of these problems are so obvious in retrospect, but so hard to find initially?
I've thought about that, and I think it comes down to people. I think everything comes down to people. Like, if you imagined a parallel universe where there was just a gazillion level 10 engineers eager to work in these factories, and they were super happy, and the factories could afford them, and you just had amazing minds everywhere, I don't think you'd have these problems because somebody would have seen that buffer wasn't there. Someone would be timing the pick and place. Somebody would see the, even they would listen, they hear the motor and they'd fix it in advance because they could hear it with their ear. Like smart people really understand this stuff everywhere could do this. It comes down to the fact that there's so many other important jobs for people to be doing. And it's hard to hire and keep really amazing talent in all these factories around the world. So you don't have enough good people. There's a 10 million labor gap. And so when you don't have all the amazing people, you have a small number of still amazing people, but they can't be everywhere at once. They're just not physically able to see, hear, look. They can't do it. And so now you need the data. And that's just a totally different skill. And we're building these skills now with data and AI, but historically we haven't been good at collecting all the data and analyzing. We've been good at using our brains to do it, right? And so we've been starting to use this word intelligent automation, right? So it's not like on putting in robots and conveyor belts, still extremely important, but can you create automation with data and analytics? Because I don't have enough great people to be watching, listening, looking at everything. And I can actually create all these other kinds of automations around the factory to run it. That's ultimately how I understand what's going on.
Excellent way to summarize why data is so important when not only do you not have as many people as you'd like, but they're probably not as tenured, so they don't necessarily notice those little things that someone that would have been at the same factory for 30 years might have noticed back in the day. So great way to put that into context. Since we're here at the end of the conversation, I do have a couple quick questions for you, but I do want to ask, is there anything about Arch Systems you wish I would have asked you that I haven't yet?
I love that question. It's been turned on me. Anybody out there who's been interviewed by me is like, oh, Andrew always asks that question. All right.
For context, I always ask this question as well. It's at the end of all my interviews.
I knew that because I've watched all of your episodes. I'll give you one thing you didn't ask, which was, you guys are doing great. I heard you're bigger, but like, how do you help factories all around the world based in the U.S.? How do you actually manage that? Are you hopping on planes all the time? Like,
that is a good question. What? How are you doing that, Andrew?
So if you had asked me that, I would have told you how when we all had to do this crazy COVID thing, we all worked from home. Arch decided to be a remote company before COVID from the beginning. So back to our three co-founders, Austin was living in Africa, and Tim and I were living in the Bay Area and traveling sometimes. And we built a remote team from the beginning. We had an office, actually 6-9 months before COVID, we shut it permanently because we were like, it doesn't even make sense to have an office. Everyone should be over Zoom. So Arch is getting close to 100 people. We're in 13 different countries around the world today. And anyone out there is, you know, curious to work for us, you know, you could be anywhere in the world and work for us. We love remote. That's its own story, but like we try to do it really, really well. But that turned out to be this amazing innovation for manufacturing because the factories are all around the world. You know, they're in the US, they're in Mexico, they're in China, they're in Eastern Europe, etc. And so even when we're really small, or even if we need to help a factory who's not as big as a Flex, you know, we have people everywhere and we can cost effectively be right near the factories all over the world. So anyways, that's something that was also somewhat accidental, just right timing, but ended up back to like product market fit, like team market fit. I think this building this remote distributed team around the world ended up being an amazing fit to serve factories all around the world as well.
Well, I appreciate that last bit of color on Arch Systems. My final question for you, we're going back to Tanzania really quickly. What was the day in the life like over there? And like, what's the number one thing you took away from that experience that has helped you at Arch Systems?
You know, people are people everywhere. And if you can solve somebody's problem, like, doesn't matter how different or similar you think you are, like, you can be the best team in the world. Right? So I would say the number one thing was just obsession with the real problem, not what you think it is, what they know it, what the customer, the user, what they know to be the problem, right? And all the way again back to those wells in the Africa. If you were with somebody who didn't even want your well, doesn't even matter the predictive maintenance. You're not going to solve it. Same in a factory. Somebody doesn't want this dashboard. They don't want the intelligent actions. Doesn't matter how good it is. Not going to matter. And then you do connect with the people, you bond with them, you have the right relationship, and they okay, now I need to solve this defect. You know, I need to get, you know, this well up. I need a maintenance. I just need somebody to come and clean it out, right? Like, okay, that's what I'm going to solve for you. I'm going to get somebody to come here and clean it back out for you. Yes, this device will help you do that. Like, okay. And I think that's what's stuck with me is just being about the people and their problem, not what you think it is, what they think it is in their eyes, and always making that the North Star.
Couldn't have picked a better way to end this conversation. Andrew, thank you for tying it all together. I really appreciate you jumping on Manufacturing Happy Hour today. Cheers.
Thank you, Chris. It was amazing.
Hey, thank you for listening. And thank you, Andrew, for jumping on today's show. You know, one of my earliest mentors in my career reached out to me about a year ago. He had actually just taken a job with Arch Systems, and he was the first person to get Andrew and the company on my radar. This was an episode we've been trying to do for a while, and it's always exciting when these come to fruition, and I hope you enjoyed it too. As I mentioned, the show notes page for this one is manufacturinghappyhour.com/186. This is episode 186. There you can get links to Well Done International. Of course, that's where you can connect with Andrew, learn more about Arch Systems, and the Amadeen Lounge is over there as well. A couple final thank yous to our sponsors for this week, Znode and Swipe Guide. And then finally, one last time, if you want to join the Manufacturing Happy Hour industry community, go to manufacturinghappyhour.com/community. That's over on LinkedIn. That'll take you straight to our LinkedIn page. It is a private group. Shoot me a message on LinkedIn, me, Chris Lukey, and then request to join the group. That way I know who you are, and I will let you right in. It's a great spot to connect with other industry leaders, lots of folks that are listening and learning from this show, and it would be great to have you there with us as well. So with that, stay innovative, stay thirsty. We will catch you again real soon.
Thanks for listening to Manufacturing Happy Hour, powered by the Industrial Network.